Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. We're living in a time where the variety of tech to help you work basically from anywhere is at an all-time high, which makes me easily fascinated with jobs that can't be done remotely, like professional opera singers, or physical therapists, or how about mathematicians studying sea ice in the Arctic Circle? The podcast Transistor is a STEM audio project where radio producers are paired with scientists to create stories as inventive as the science they're presenting. This episode of Transistor takes us thousands of miles away into temperatures far below freezing to the worksite of the so-called Indiana Jones of mathematics. Don't worry, there won't be any snakes. This is Transistor, a science series from PRX.
I'm Genevieve Sponsler from PRX, and this is probably not a good confession to make, considering I'm hosting a science, tech, and math podcast. But I was one of those students who thought I wasn't going to need math. I still resist it sometimes, but then there are reminders of its importance. Like last week, I was sitting at a table next to a bunch of high school teachers at a diner, and they were talking about the Pythagorean theorem and how useful it is, and how hard that is to relay to students. This story from Ben Hardin is a reminder of the cool things math can do, away from desks and out in the world, at the Arctic Circle, to be precise.
100 miles from land, ice and snow extend in every direction, a landscape of intense white. Except for a dot of bright blue, that's Ken Golden's jacket.
Right now we're on part of the Arctic Ocean. We're standing on first-year sea ice that's about 1 meter thick.
Ken wields a drill half his height. He's standing over it like he would a jackhammer, and he's drilling down through the ice.
You can feel some soft layers up near the surface. It's a very beautiful and unique setting to be in here, especially for a math professor.
You see, Ken's a little different than most people who work in the Arctic. He's a mathematician. In fact, he's even been called the Indiana Jones of mathematics. Yeah, that's Ken. Clearly he digs the reference.
Doing mathematics, but going off to these crazy, far-flung places throughout the world and getting in all kinds of dangerous situations.
Working out on thin sea ice, getting stuck on the wrong side of giant fractures. Once he was on board a burning ship.
A burning ship in Antarctica, my first time there.
But Ken's not doing these things just to brag. He uses these adventures to solve mysteries. Along the way, he makes connections between things you'd never think about linking up. Which brings us back to the ice that Ken's drilling into.
Perfect, just what we wanted.
Ken pulls a thin cylinder of ice out of the hole he's drilled. He puts his eye right up to it. He's looking inside the ice. It's not like a clear column of glass. It's riddled with tiny channels that make it look milky white.
That's the unique thing about sea ice that many people don't realize. They say, oh, it's frozen water. It's just a solid piece of ice. But of course, in fact, it's very different from the ice cubes in a drink. That's pure water that's been frozen. Basically, it's a solid. But when seawater freezes, the salt sort of interferes.
The water molecules can't freeze with all that salt in the way. So the salt gets pushed to one side. What you end up with are these tiny channels of super salty water that run throughout the ice. And it's these channels that make sea ice different from the ice that comes out of your freezer. This ice is permeable. That means water can flow through it.
Yeah, sea ice is just an amazing substance. From extremely permeable all the way down to just almost like a granite.
Now, being able to predict when water can flow through ice isn't just something that's interesting to an obscure group of Arctic scientists. It matters. It dictates how sea ice freezes, how quickly ice can melt, how strong that ice is. Real things that help climate scientists understand how our planet is changing and how fast. But until Ken came along on one of his adventures in 1994, no one knew what conditions allowed water to flow through ice.
And one fateful night, it was in the middle of a raging storm. Winds were blowing probably 40, 50 knots. And I was out on the sea ice All of a sudden, I see seawater flooding up on the surface and flooding the snow layer.
Right before his eyes, he was watching the sea ice switching from an impermeable granite to a permeable, leaky solid.
And literally in that instant, sort of all these bells went off in my head.
Math bells. He knew immediately what math to use to understand what was happening. It's called percolation theory.
So percolation theory, I like to call the theory of connectedness.
It goes like this. Think of the ice as a maze full of channels, some that connect, others at dead end, all spread out through the ice. And the question is, how do you know when water can make it through that maze?
You might think, well, gee, to predict something so complicated, you might need a very detailed theory that incorporates all the gory details of sea ice microstructure. But that's not true.
Ken's theory is simple. Forget about solving the maze, charting all the twists and turns. Forget knowing exactly how the channels are connected. Ken says all you have to know is how many channels there are. If there are enough channels, they'll connect. According to the math, they have to. And you get more channels the warmer the ice is.
Coldest, a bunch of individual inclusions.
Very few water channels, all unconnected, nothing flows.
A little bit warmer, they start to grow.
Maybe a few channels start to join up.
Even warmer, they start to connect up with each other.
Larger groups of channels form.
And then finally, at a much higher temperature, it's like a continuous filament.
All of a sudden, continuous routes open up through the maze. You simply use the temperature to predict how many channels there are, and percolation theory will tell you if water can find a way through. The math doesn't even care about where exactly the water flows, just that it can, somewhere. Ken's intuition for using this math came from an unlikely place.
The answer was provided by realizing that the microstructure of sea ice is strikingly similar to the microstructure of radar-absorbing stealthy materials. Stealth technology, what they coat these aircraft with.
This might sound like quite a leap, but go with him for a second. The material that makes an aircraft invisible absorbs radar waves by turning them into electricity. This electricity then escapes through the material in tiny, complicated channels. Sound familiar?
I finally realized, hey, I think this is like sea ice.
Being a mathematician, Ken knew it didn't matter what the substance was, or even what was flowing through it, only that the principle is the same. All Ken had to do was borrow the stealth shielding math, make a couple of adjustments, and he could predict at which temperature ice becomes permeable. And just last year, he took this one step further. He realized that the same math that explains sea ice can explain what's happening in the bones of people with osteoporosis.
With osteoporosis, what's the problem? I mean, you've got a matrix of solid bone, and then what's filled into the holes is more fluid, you know, blood and fluid. And anyway, I'm not an expert on bone.
But turns out he doesn't have to be.
From a mathematical standpoint, it's an almost identical problem.
And so Ken used the ice math to develop a new method for imaging bones. This kind of thing is what he's all about, seeing math connections between subjects he often knows nothing about. But to make these connections, he has to get out from behind his desk, out into the world.
So to speak, getting your hands dirty, or frozen, as the case may be.
And while the Indiana Jones thing may be a little bit of a stretch,
I think it's good for mathematics. That's why I've allowed it to kind of propagate and to persist, because I think the general public has a certain view of mathematicians. Head in the clouds, they don't do anything that is applicable to reality and so on. But of course, mathematics is very applicable to reality.
For this Indiana Jones, math is the key not just for unlocking the mysteries of the world, but figuring out how to connect them over and over again. From the Arctic sea ice, I'm Ben Harden.
Ben brought us that story last year. He's a scientist too, and has a new gig as an assistant professor of oceanography at Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. He'll be teaching undergrads aboard tall ships during their semester at sea. As always, visit us at transistor.prx.org for episode extras, like photos of Ken Golden in the Arctic. The Transistor team includes me, I'm Genevieve Sponsler, PRX Chief Content Officer John Barth, Erica Lance, and Lily Bowie. Transistor is supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More at sloan.org. This is PRX.
You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best stories from indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Last year, award-winning radio producer and reporter Lou Olkowski debuted the radio series Cargo Land, which tells the stories of the people anchored to the waterfront community of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. The men and women who load and unload the ships in the harbor belong to one of the last truly strong American unions, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. ILWU longshoremen have the kind of working-class jobs that you can still raise a family on, the kind of jobs most Americans would probably love to have, but we rarely hear about what it takes to get one of those great jobs on the waterfront. In part three of the five-part radio series Cargo Land, Lou meets two of the 6,000 workers trying to earn a spot in the ILWU.
You can't just walk off the street and say, "I'd like to be a longshoreman. How do I apply?" There are no job listings on Monster or Career Builder. There's no way to send a cover letter or resume. There's no application to fill out. You have to start off as what they call a casual. Casuals take on whatever overflow work the regular workers can't cover. And the best description I've heard of being a casual worker, and by best, I mean the most poetic description, comes from a guy named Sasha Karlik, who's been a casual for 10 years.
If you're willing to camp out on the front porch of the palace and greedily take every crumb we throw at you for 2, 4, 6, 10, 12 years, we'll invite you in to have a permanent seat at the banquet.
In this analogy, the banquet is the union, specifically the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or the ILWU. And a permanent seat at the banquet means becoming a union member, a registered longshoreman. Registered longshoremen earn six-figure salaries. They get medical benefits, pensions, and paid vacations.
Eventually.
Casuals get none of that.
Till then, it's like, you got no status, you're a third-class citizen, and that's kind of what it is being a casual.
They don't even get day-to-day guarantee of employment. What they get is more like a regular spot in a very long line.
Okay, you reached casual for Monday night.
Waiting for a job.
34 casts, 431 jobs, it's 431.
What you're hearing is the casual hotline, which lets workers know who works when. Every casual is assigned a letter and a number, something like W4531. Then they call in every day to see if there's work.
Starting off the letter W4531, that's worship, 4531, call back after 2:30 for your final.
That first letter W, that's your group number. If your group number is up, you and all the other W's head down to the casual hiring hall. Hiring hall sounds kind of grand, but it's just a parking lot, littered with cigarette butts and broken-down office chairs. On the edge of the lot, there's one building. It looks a lot like a run-down taco stand, except in the window where you would have placed an order, you get a job assignment. To get a shift, you have to be physically at the hall, at the window, with your ID card out, in the right spot in line, exactly when your number is called.
If you're in line, have your card out, be ready. If you're pulling your card out at the window, you are going to flop. If you are out of order, even by one person, you are done. All right, you guys been told, call back after 2:30 for your final.
If you miss your job, you have to wait for your number to come around all over again. That could take a day, a week, or a month, depending on how busy the port is.
You drop everything. People drop everything to be down at the hall.
This is Richard, another casual. He didn't want to use his last name.
When I hear it getting like, you know, three or four letters before my letter, I'm going to go down.
Here we go for Thursday morning, August 21st. Hold on to your crime fighters. 1,275 jobs. That's 1,275. We'll be starting off in the letter P, 4747. If you're up close, come on down.
And you might go down to the hall and you might not even get a job. And if you don't get a job in the morning, you go in the evening, in the afternoon.
Thursday night, early forecast,
And it's possible you wait again and not get a job that night. So what you're going to do is you drive back home again, wake up and go back to the hall. And then again, you might not get a job. So you'll come back again later in the afternoon and do the process again.
We'll be starting off with the letter H.
I've done this 3-4 days in a row sometimes, maybe all week. Every day.
Come on down. If you're up close, come on down. If you're up close, come on down.
I'll see you in the morning. Okay, this is a casual haul for Tuesday morning, August 26th.
And the job's not there. But when you're so close to getting a job, you don't want to miss it. At that point, you realize that you've spent more gas. You realize that you used up all the money that you would have made on that job. So now you really have to work. Because you got to get that money back somehow. It gets gloomy waiting out there, you know. It does.
I ask him why he does it.
Why do it?
Well, that's it. I'm doing it because at this point for me and in my life, there's no other job I could actually get to make money like this. Just the basic pay, you know, could be anywhere around $27 an hour. You wonder and you fantasize and you dream about getting 3 and 4 days, maybe even 5 days would be just amazing. What a paycheck that would be. That keeps you going.
How did it get to the point that there are 6,000 men and women waking up every morning to call a hotline to see if they'll get a chance to work? Well, it goes back to 2004, when business at the port was booming. In fact, it couldn't process the cargo fast enough. So the union and the employers brought in some new casuals to pick up the slack. And they hired people in a way that frankly sounds crazy to me. They held a raffle. Guys who wanted to be considered for the job were told to mail in a postcard with their name and address.
One postcard only.
This is, by the way, the same process you go through if you want to be an audience member on Saturday Night Live. They got 300,000 postcards, and altogether they pulled 18,000 names. Of those 18,000, Sasha Karlik was number 148.
And I knew that was pretty good luck, but I didn't realize how fortunate it was, how much of an opportunity it was to be right in the fore of it.
Because he was one of the first people picked, he was one of the first to be trained and put to work. And because casuals with the most hours would be the first hired as registered longshoremen, it put Sasha in the best possible position to get into the union.
There's a common phrase that the regulars in the union often repeated in those first few months, congratulations, you won the lottery. You know, like, you're a lucky winner, you son of a gun, you know? And it's like, I won the lottery, but I still got to come to work.
Like I said, casuals with the most hours get in first. But it's not like you're automatically admitted into the union when you hit a certain number of hours. There are formal enrollment periods that are very rare. The last one was 7 years ago. At that point, Sasha had been a casual for over 2 years, but he didn't have enough hours to make the cut. There were two rounds of hiring.
So I missed the first one by like 200 hours, I think, and the second cut I missed by like 80 hours. And there were some people like right near me who missed by one shift, by 8 hours, you know, and they're still there working with me, you know, and some people I heard missed by like as little as 15 or 30 minutes.
We should have had a different dynamic on how we transition people.
James Spinoza used to be president of the union. When Spinoza says they should have had a different dynamic, he just means the process of going from casual to union member is all wrong.
Rather than just waiting for years and years and years. It should have been something on an attrition basis, or you have to take in so many a year. Then we created our own problem.
And the problem is only getting worse.
There are about 6,000 casuals like Sasha and Richard trying to get into the union. And there are a couple of automated terminals under construction, which means more of the work is going to be done by machines instead of people. When those terminals open, there will be even less work for the casuals. Some are estimating each automated terminal will need 50% fewer people.
I don't know what to say or do about it, except got to just keep on going.
Again, here's Sasha.
And I'm, you know, like so many of us are in a catch-22. You know, I've invested 10 years of my prime. You know, I'm not getting younger. And now if I walk out and just like stop taking every job I can possibly get to, then almost guaranteed I won't get in the union.
I ask him, but do you have faith that it's going to work out?
I have a strong survival instinct that I gotta survive. So I keep treading water, but I have very little faith. But I just, maybe it's a little bit of hypocrisy to be hopeful, to be optimistic that, you know, I'll somehow survive and get through this. But that's just my personal thing.
And Richard, he just keeps his head down and keeps working.
You know, this job has come through. It's still there. You know, right when I'm on the E on my gas tank, I get a paycheck. And so I filled up that tank. It gets me through.
Okay, here we go. Thursday morning. Hold on to your tantarans. It looks like another good day. We have 1,400 jobs for tomorrow. You heard that right. That's 1400. We'll be starting off in the letter U, 4812. That's Union 4812. If you're on the call, be here.
Cargoland is a five-part radio series conceived, written, and produced by Lou Olkowski and edited by Samara Freemark, Sean Cole, and Brendan Baker, along with KCRW's Independent Producers Project. You can listen to all five radio stories at cargoland.kcrw.com, and you can subscribe to the series on iTunes. Recently, the Hoover Dam celebrated its 80th birthday. When I look at grand examples of American engineering, like the dam or the ports as we just heard about in the previous story, I imagine the people who labored to make those structures possible, as the daughter of a carpenter, like myself, might be inclined to do. I imagine what they ate for lunch on the work sites, how late they arrived at home at the end of the day, what songs they might have sung in their head as they toiled. From the historical podcast, The Memory Palace, here's a look at the story behind who built the Hoover Dam and how the stars, yes, the ones in the sky, might help us remember them for centuries to come.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nathan Mayo. In 1931, at the height of the Depression, people began hearing that there were going to be jobs in Nevada. They needed men there to build an enormous dam that would be named after President Herbert Hoover. 5,000 men, former commodities traders, former obstetricians, packed up their families and drove to the desert, some of them leaving behind the plywood and scrap metal shanty towns that were also named after Herbert Hoover. When they got there, they found that there were jobs, but that the houses and schools and movie theaters that were supposed to be there hadn't been built yet. So they hammered some posts into the ground and strung up some sheets that could keep the desert sun off their kids and their wives, and they went to work. 96 of those men died when the harnesses that fastened them to the canyon wall 800 feet in the air snapped. When the hearts of 50-year-old men who were used to selling women's hosiery or teaching geometry, when their hearts gave out after working 10-hour shifts in 130-degree heat, chipping a mile-long tunnel beneath the desert, inch by inch. When others fell into wet concrete and had to be pulled out, not before they died, then before the concrete set, and they became a permanent part of a large public works project. But not long after they finished the dam, orange groves and alfalfa fields and baseball diamonds and whole cities grew in the desert. There's a monument at the Hoover Dam. There are these two enormous bronze angels that are supposed to embody the spirit of the men who designed and built the dam, in American progress or whatever. But my favorite part of the monument, my favorite thing about the whole damn dam, is actually at the angels' feet. There's an Art Deco astronomical chart there, done in Terrazzo, and it's lovely. And there's some text there that tells you that on September 20th, 1935, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt dedicated the dam. The text goes on to explain that the chart on the ground shows the precise alignment of the heavens at exactly 8:56 when FDR spoke, the same moment that a flagpole that stands between the two angels was aimed straight at the heart of the sun. Because they were sure we would care. There's a separate section on the chart that supposedly depicts the precise astronomical location of an Egyptian pyramid when it was aligned, Hoover Dam flagpole style, with the yonder star that the frankincense-toting wise men followed to get to the baby Jesus, thereby ushering in the Christian era. I love this, because it means that so convinced were the makers of the Hoover Dam that what these men had just built was so world historic, so new epic usheringly awesome, that a plaque wouldn't suffice. So they designed this chart, working with astronomers at the Naval Observatory at the Smithsonian. So thousands of years from now, even in an apparently post-English world, when the text right there next to the chart would somehow have been rendered useless, people, or perhaps aliens, could know. They'd be able to do the math and figure out the exact moment when FDR had a day clear in his calendar to say a few words at the Hoover Dam, now the 35th largest hydroelectric plant in the world, and according to the state's tourism website, the 9th best thing to do in Nevada. Number 10 is golf.
That was an early episode of the podcast The Memory Palace, produced and hosted by Nate DeMayo. He releases episodes on a weekly basis, and you can find out how to subscribe to the show at thememorypalace.us. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. I'd love to hear about the podcasts you've been enjoying lately. Send me your suggestions for future episodes of The Spot to thespot@kalw.org. And tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.